Chapter 3. One World or Many? Bell Arverden, fresh from his interview with the press, on the occasion of his forthcoming expedition to Earth, felt at supreme peace with all the 100 million star systems that composed the all-embracing galactic empire. It was no longer a question of being known in this sector or that. Let his theories concerning Earth be proven, and his reputation would be assured on every inhabited planet of the Milky Way, on every planet that man had set foot through the hundreds of thousands of years of expansion through space. These potential heights of renown, these pure and rarefied intellectual peaks of science, were coming to him early, yet not easily. He was scarcely 35, but already his career had been packed with controversy. It had begun with an explosion that had rocked the halls of the University of Arcturus when he first graduated as senior archaeologist from that institution at the unprecedented age of 23. The explosion, no less effective for being immaterial, consisted of the rejection for publication on the part of the Journal of the Galactic Archaeological Society of his senior dissertation. It was the first time in the history of the university that a senior dissertation had been rejected. It was equally the first time in the history of that staid professional journal that a rejection had been couched in such blunt terms. To a non-archaeologist, the reason for such anger against an obscure and dry little pamphlet entitled On the Antiquity of Artifacts in the Sirius Sector, with Considerations of the Application Thereof to the Radiation Hypothesis of Human Origin, might seem mysterious. What was involved, however, was that from the first, Arverden adopted as his own the hypothesis advanced earlier by certain groups of mystics who were more concerned with metaphysics than with archaeology, i.e., that humanity had originated upon some single planet and had radiated by degrees throughout the galaxy. This was a favorite theory of the fantasy writers of the day, and the bête noire of every respectable archaeologist of the empire. But Arverden became a force to be reckoned with by even the most respectable, for within the decade he had become the recognized authority on the relics of the pre-empire cultures still left in the eddies and quiet backwaters of the galaxy. For instance, he had written a monograph on the mechanistic civilization of the Rigel sector, where the development of robots created a separate culture that persisted for centuries till the very perfection of the metal slaves reduced the human initiative to the point where the vigorous fleets of the warlord Moray took easy control. Orthodox archaeology insisted on the evolution of human types independently on various planets and used such atypical cultures as that on Rigel as examples of race differences that had not yet been ironed out through intermarriage. Arverden destroyed such concepts effectively by showing that Rigelian robot culture was but a natural outgrowth of the economic and social forces of the times and of the region. Then there were the barbarous worlds of Ophiuchus, which the Orthodox had long upheld as samples of primitive humanity not yet advanced to the stage of interstellar travel. Every textbook used those worlds as the best evidence of the merger theory, i.e., that humanity was the natural climax of evolution on any world based upon a water-oxygen chemistry with proper intensities of temperature and gravitation, that each independent strain of humanity could intermarry, that with the discovery of interstellar travel, such intermarriage took place. Arverden, however, uncovered traces of the early civilization that had preceded the then-thousand-year-old barbarism of Ophiuchus and proved that the earliest records of the planet showed traces of interstellar trade. The final touch came when he demonstrated beyond any doubt that man had emigrated to the region in an already civilized state. It was after that that the J. Gal Arcsoc, to give the journal its professional abbreviation, decided to print Arverden's senior dissertation more than 10 years after it had been presented. And now the pursuit of his pet theory led Arverden to probably the least significant planet of the Empire, the planet called Earth. Arverden landed at that one spot of Empire on all Earth, that patch among the desolate heights of the plateaus north of the Himalayas, There, where radioactivity was not, and never had been, there gleamed a palace that was not of terrestrial architecture. In essence, it was a copy of the viceregal palaces that existed on more fortunate worlds. The soft lushness of the grounds was built for comfort. The forbidding rocks had been covered with topsoil, watered, immersed in an artificial atmosphere and climate, and converted into 5 square miles of lawns and flower gardens. The cost in energy involved in this performance was terrific by earthly calculations, but it had behind it the completely incredible resources of tens of millions of planets continually growing in number. It has been estimated that in the year of the galactic era 827, an average of 50 new planets each day were achieving the dignity of provincial status, this condition requiring the attainment of a population of 500 millions. In this spot of non-Earth lived the procurator of Earth, and sometimes in this artificial luxury he could forget that he was a procurator of a rat-hole world and remember that he was an aristocrat of great honor and ancient family. His wife was perhaps less often deluded, particularly at such times as, topping a grassy knoll, she could see in the distance the sharp, decisive line separating the grounds from the fierce wilderness of Earth. It was then that not all the colored fountains, luminescent at night with an effect of cold liquid fire, flowered walks, or idyllic groves could compensate for the knowledge of their exile. So perhaps Arvardhan was welcomed even more than protocol might call for. To the procurator, after all, Arvardhan was a breath of empire, of spaciousness, of boundlessness. And Arvardhan, for his part, found much to admire. He said, "This is done well, and with taste. It is amazing how a touch of the central culture permeates the most outlying districts of our empire, Lord Ennius." Ennius smiled. "I'm afraid the procurator's court here on Earth is more pleasant to visit than to live in. It is but a shell that rings hollowly when touched. When you have considered myself and family, the staff, the imperial garrison, both here and in the important planetary centers, together with an occasional visitor such as yourself, you have exhausted all the touch of the central culture that exists. It seems scarcely enough." They sat in the colonnade in the dying afternoon, with the sun glinting downward toward the mist-purple jags of the horizon, and the air so heavy with the scent of growing things that its motions were merely sighs of exertion. It was, of course, not quite suitable for even a procurator to show too great a curiosity about the doings of a guest, but that does not take into account the inhumanity of day-to-day isolation from all the empire. Ennius said, "Do you plan to stay for some time, Dr. Arvardhan?"
"As to that, Lord Ennius, I cannot surely say. I have come ahead of the rest of my expedition in order to acquaint myself with Earth's culture and to fulfill the necessary legal requirements. For instance, I must obtain the usual official permission from you to establish camps at the necessary sites and so on."
"Oh, granted, granted. But when do you start digging? And whatever can you possibly expect to find on this miserable heap of rubble?"
"I hope, if all goes well, to be able to set up camp in a few months. And as to this world, why, it's anything but a miserable heap. It is absolutely unique in the galaxy."
"Unique," said the procurator stiffly. "Not at all. It is a very ordinary world. It is more or less of a pig pen of a world, or a horrible hole of a world, or a cesspool of a world, or almost any other particularly derogative adjective you care to use. And yet, with all its refinement of nausea, it cannot even achieve uniqueness in villainy, but remains an ordinary, brutish peasant world."
"But," said Arvardhan, somewhat taken aback by the energy of the inconsistent statements thus thrown at him, "the world is radioactive."
"Well, what of that? Some thousands of planets in the galaxy are radioactive, and some are considerably more so than Earth."
It was at this moment that the soft gliding motion of the mobile cabinet attracted their attention. It came to a halt within easy hand reach. Ennius gestured toward it and said to the other,
"What would you prefer?"
"I'm not particular. A lime twist, perhaps."
That can be handled.
The cabinet will have the ingredients, with or without Cenci.
Just about a tang of it, said Arvidin, and held up his forefinger and thumb, nearly touching.
You'll have it in a minute.
Somewhere in the bowels of the cabinet, perhaps the most universally popular mechanical offspring of human ingenuity, a bartender went into action. A non-human bartender whose electronic soul mixed things not by jiggers but by atom counts, whose ratios were perfect every time, and who could not be matched by all the inspired artistry of anyone merely human. The tall glasses appeared from nowhere, it seemed, as they waited in the appropriate recesses. Arvidin took the green one and, for a moment, felt the chill of it against his cheek. Then he placed the rim to his lips and tasted.
Just right, he said.
He placed the glass in the well-fitted holder in the arm of his chair and said, Thousands of radioactive planets, Procurator, just as you say, but only one of them is inhabited. This one, Procurator.
Well...
Ennius smacked his lips over his own drink and seemed to lose some of his sharpness after contact with its velvet.
Perhaps it is unique in that way. It's an unenviable distinction.
But it is not just a question of statistical uniqueness. Arvidin spoke deliberately between occasional sips. It goes further. It has tremendous potentialities. Biologists have shown, or claim to have shown, that on planets in which the intensity of radioactivity in the atmosphere and in the seas is above a certain point, life will not develop. Earth's radioactivity is above that point by a considerable margin.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I imagine that this would constitute definite proof that Earth life is fundamentally different from that of the rest of the galaxy. That should suit you, since you're from Sirius.
He seemed sardonically amused at this point, and said in a confidential aside,
Do you know that the biggest single difficulty involved in ruling this planet lies in coping with the intense anti-terrestrialism that exists throughout the entire Sirius sector? And the feeling is returned with interest on the part of these Earthmen. I'm not saying, of course, that anti-terrestrialism doesn't exist in more or less diluted form in many places in the galaxy, but not like on Sirius.
Arvidin's response was impatient and vehement. Lord Ennius, I reject the implication. I have as little intolerance in me as any man living. I believe in the oneness of humanity to my very scientific core, and that includes even Earth. And all life is fundamentally one, in that it is all based upon protein complexes and colloidal dispersion, which we call protoplasm. The effect of radioactivity that I just talked of does not apply simply to some forms of human life or to some forms of any life. It applies to all life, since it is based upon the quantum mechanics of the protein molecules. It applies to you, to me, to Earthmen, to spiders, and to germs. You see, proteins, as I probably needn't tell you, are immensely complicated groupings of amino acids and certain other specialized compounds arranged in intricate three-dimensional patterns that are as unstable as sunbeams on a cloudy day. It is this instability that is life, since it is forever changing its position in an effort to maintain its identity, in the manner of a long rod balanced on an acrobat's nose. But this marvelous chemical, this protein, must be first built up out of inorganic matter before life can exist. So at the very beginning, by the influence of the sun's radiant energy upon those huge solutions we call oceans, organic molecules gradually increase in complexity, from methane to formaldehyde, and finally to sugars and starches in one direction, and from urea to amino acids and proteins in another direction. It's a matter of chance, of course, these combinations and disintegrations of atoms, and the process on one world may take millions of years, while on another it may take only hundreds. Of course, it is much more probable that it will take millions of years. In fact, it is most probable that it will end up never happening. Now physical organic chemists have worked out with great exactness all the reaction chain involved, particularly the energetics thereof, that is, the energy relationships involved in each atom shift. It is now known, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that several of the crucial steps in the building of life require the absence of radiant energy. If this strikes you as queer, Procurator, I can only say that photochemistry, the chemistry of reactions induced by radiant energy, is a well-developed branch of the science, and there are innumerable cases of very simple reactions which will go in one of two different directions, depending on whether it takes place in the presence or absence of quanta of light energy. In ordinary worlds, the sun is the only source of radiant energy, or at least by far the major source. In the shelter of clouds or at night, the carbon and nitrogen compounds combine and recombine in the fashions made possible by the absence of those little bits of energy hurled into the midst of them by the sun, like bowling balls into the midst of an infinite number of infinitesimal tenpins. But on radioactive worlds, sun or no sun, every drop of water, even in the deepest night, even 5 miles under, sparkles and bursts with darting gamma rays, kicking up the carbon atoms, activating them, the chemists say, and forcing certain key reactions to proceed only in certain ways, ways that never result in life. Arvidin's drink was gone. He placed the empty glass on the waiting cabinet. It was withdrawn instantly into the special compartment where it was cleaned, sterilized, and made ready for the next drink.
"Another one?" asked Ennius.
"Ask me after dinner," said Arvidin. "I've had quite enough for now." Ennius tapped a tapering fingernail upon the arm of his chair and said, "You make the process sound quite fascinating, but if all is as you say, then what about the life on Earth? How did it develop?"
"Ah, you see, even you are beginning to wonder. But the answer, I think, is simple.
Radioactivity, in excess of the minimum required to prevent life, is still not necessarily sufficient to destroy life already formed. It might modify it, but except in comparatively huge excess, it will not destroy it. You see, the chemistry involved is different. In the first case, simple molecules must be prevented from building up, while in the second, already formed complex molecules must be broken down. Not at all the same thing."
"I don't get the application of that at all," said Ennius.
"Isn't it obvious? Life on Earth originated before the planet became radioactive. My dear procurator, it is the only possible explanation that does not involve denying either the fact of life on Earth or enough chemical theory to upset half the science."
Ennius gazed at the other in amazed disbelief. "But you can't mean that."
"Why not?"
"Because how can a world become radioactive? The life of the radioactive elements in the planet's crust are in the millions and billions of years. I've learned that, at least, during my university career, even in a pre-law course. They must have existed indefinitely in the past."
"But there is such a thing as artificial radioactivity, Lord Ennius, even on a huge scale. There are thousands of nuclear reactions of sufficient energy to create all sorts of radioactive isotopes. Why, if we were to suppose that human beings might use some applied nuclear reaction in industry without proper controls, or even in war, if you can imagine anything like a war proceeding on a single planet, most of the topsoil could conceivably be converted into artificially radioactive materials. What do you say to that?"
The sun had expired in blood on the mountains, and Ennius's thin face was ruddy in the reflection of that process. The gentle evening wind stirred, and the drowsy murmur of the carefully selected varieties of insect life upon the palace grounds was more soothing than ever.
Ennius said, "It sounds very artificial to me. For one thing, I can't conceive using nuclear reactions in war, or letting them get out of control to this extent in any manner."
"Naturally, sir, you tend to underestimate nuclear reactions because you're living in the present, when they're so easily controlled. But what if someone, or some army, used such weapons before the defense had been worked out? For instance, it's like using firebombs before anyone knew that water or sand would put out fire."
"Hmm," said Ennius. "You sound like Schecht."
"Who's Schecht?" Arvidin looked up quickly.
"An Earthman. One of the few decent ones. I mean one that a gentleman can speak to. He's a physicist. He told me once that Earth might not always have been radioactive."
"Ah, well, that's not unusual, since the theory is certainly not original with me. It's part of the Book of the Ancients, which contains the traditional or mythical history of prehistoric Earth. I'm saying what it says, in a way, except that I'm putting its rather elliptical phraseology into equivalent scientific statements.
The Book of the Ancients?
Ennius seemed surprised and a little upset.
Where did you get that?
Here and there. It wasn't easy, and I only obtained parts. Of course, all this traditional information about non-radioactivity, even where completely unscientific, is important to my project.
Why do you ask?
Because the book is the revered text of a radical sect of Earthmen. It is forbidden for outsiders to read it. I wouldn't broadcast the fact that you did, either, while you're here. Non-Earthmen, or outsiders, as they call them, have been lynched for less. You make it sound as if the Imperial police power here is defective.
It is, in cases of sacrilege. A word to the wise, Dr. Arvidan.
A melodious chime sounded a vibrant note that seemed to harmonize with the rustling whisper of the trees. It faded out slowly, lingering as though in love with its surroundings.
Ennius rose. I believe it is time for dinner. Will you join me, sir, and enjoy such hospitality as this husk of empire on earth can afford?
An occasion for an elaborate dinner came infrequently enough. An excuse, even a slim one, was not to be missed. So the courses were many, the surroundings lavish, the men polished, and the women bewitching. And, it must be added, Dr. B. Arvidan of Baran Sirius was lionized to quite an intoxicating extent. Arvidan took advantage of his dinner audience during the latter portion of the banquet to repeat much of what he had said to Ennius, but here his exposition met with markedly less success. A florid gentleman in colonel's uniform leaned toward him with that marked condescension of the military man for the scholar, and said,
If I interpret your expressions rightly, Dr. Arvidan, you are trying to tell us that these hounds of Earth represent an ancient race that may once have been the ancestors of all humanity?
I hesitate, Colonel, to make the flat assertion, but I think there is an interesting chance that it might be so. A year from now, I confidently hope to be able to make a definite judgment.
If you find that they are, Doctor, which I strongly doubt, rejoined the Colonel, you will astonish me beyond measure. I have been stationed on Earth now for 4 years, and my experience is not of the smallest. I find these Earthmen to be rogues and knaves, every one of them. They are definitely our inferiors intellectually. They lack that spark that has spread humanity throughout the galaxy. They are lazy, superstitious, avaricious, and with no trace of nobility of soul. I defy you or anyone to show me an Earthman who can in any way be an equal of any true man. Yourself or myself, for instance. And only then will I grant you that he may represent a race who once were our ancestors. But until then, please excuse me for making any such assumption.
A portly man at the foot of the table said suddenly,
They say the only good Earthman is a dead Earthman, and that even then they generally stink,
and laughed immoderately. Arvidan frowned at the dish before him and said, without looking up,
I have no desire to argue racial differences, especially since it is irrelevant in this case. It is the Earthman of prehistory that I speak of. His descendants of today have been long isolated and have been subjected to a most unusual environment. Yet I still would not dismiss them too casually.
He turned to Ennius and said, My lord, I believe you mentioned an Earthman before dinner.
I did. I don't recall.
A physicist. Schecht.
Oh, yes, yes.
Afret Schecht, perhaps?
Why, yes. Have you heard of him?
I think I have. It's been bothering me all through dinner, ever since you mentioned him, but I think I've placed him. He wouldn't be at the Institute of Nuclear Research at... Oh, what's the name of that damned place?
He struck at his forehead with the heel of his palm once or twice.
At Shika?
You have the right person. What about him?
Only this. There was an article by him in the August issue of Physical Reviews. I noticed it because I was looking for anything that had to do with Earth, and articles by Earthmen in journals of galactic circulation are very rare. In any case, the point I'm trying to make is that the man claims to have developed something he calls a synapsifier,
which is supposed to improve the learning capacity of the mammalian nervous system.
Really? Said Ennius, a bit too sharply. I haven't heard about it.
I can find you the reference. It's quite an interesting article, though, of course, I can't pretend to understand the mathematics involved. What he has done, however, has been to treat some indigenous animal form on Earth, rats, I believe they call them, with the synapsifier, and then put them to solving a maze. You know what I mean, learning the proper pathway through a tiny labyrinth to some food supply. He used non-treated rats as controls and found that in every case, the synapsified rats solved the maze in less than one-third the time. Do you see the significance, Colonel?
The military man who had initiated the discussion said indifferently,
No, Doctor, I do not.
I'll explain, then, that I firmly believe that any scientist capable of doing such work, even an Earthman, is certainly my intellectual equal, at least, and, if you'll pardon my presumption, yours as well.
Ennius interrupted.
Pardon me, Dr. Arvidin. I would like to return to the synapsifier. Has Schecht experimented with human beings?
Arvidin laughed.
I doubt it, Lord Ennius. 9/10 of his synapsified rats died during treatment. He would scarcely dare use human subjects until much more progress has been made.
So Ennius sank back into his chair with a slight frown on his forehead, and thereafter neither spoke nor ate for the remainder of the dinner. Before midnight, the procurator had quietly left the gathering and, with a bare word to his wife only, departed in his private cruiser on the 2-hour trip to the city of Shika, with the slight frown still on his forehead and a raging anxiety in his heart. Thus it was that on the same afternoon that Arben Marin brought Joseph Schwartz into Shika for treatment with Schecht's synapsifier, Schecht himself had been closeted with none less than the Procurator of Earth for over an hour.